there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's been a minute.
We've been having a lot of fun around the holidays, and so we have not been recording, but now we are back.
We are back. I went on a little trip to New Zealand, 3 weeks, 1 week too long, but I am glad to be home. Jet lag, oh my God, who knew it could last like a week?
Yep. And I had a vacation, but more distracting, I have found a publisher for my new book.
Huzzah! Kim got a publisher for her book!
Yes. So, yes. Very, very exciting. And it's a small press called River Folk, and we'll see where all that goes.
I'm so excited! Kim's like the boy who lived, or the girl who lived, really. Harriet Potter.
Yes. We shall never escape the references, shall we? It just fits too well.
It does. It does. Although I really hate Harry Potter as an example, as longtime listeners of this podcast will know. But Kim, congratulations. It couldn't have happened to a better lady. I love you, my dear. Mm-hmm. You're amazing.
And I will say that actually writing that book, I used so much of the stuff from Bickham and also from Bird by Bird. Just the craft books actually do help.
What about Gardner?
Well, you know, he had that whole idea about, you know, turning trash into art. But other than that.
Yeah, right. Anyway, Kim is amazing. She did it. And, you know, it's amazing watching her, like, from an objective point of view, dear listener. I have seen her from the moment of its creation. I remember her coming to me and saying, Renee, I went on a trip and I got this great idea.
And you smiled so hard and were so supportive.
No. It was a little weird, but I was like, sure. That sounds great. I'm like, maybe she'll write herself out of this. But no, there was enough there. There was so much substance, and it grew and grew. And, you know, I've gotten to hear about it. I've gotten to read it. Ha! I've got front row seat tickets to that book. So that makes me pretty special, I like to say. So yeah, I've seen it before it was even born, and now it's born, and I can't wait to hold it and swaddle it, and
it's going to be a series. I'm entitling it Boy Bands and Dragons.
Really?
Yes. So they'll
Boy Bands and Dragons.
Yes. Yeah, individual books, but yeah.
Nice. Nice. And what's the name of this book?
It's going to be What Our Comeback Tour is Slaying Monsters, Unless They Choose to Change the Name.
Nice. Unless they choose. Oh, that's so. Kim, will you keep us apprised of the interesting things going on in the publishing process?
I will definitely do that. Yeah.
Okay, good. So you're going to help us out.
Well, so this was my year to finish the book and find a publisher, because I got the offer on December 22nd, 2023. And now 2024 is your year for the memoir.
Sure. Yes. We hope.
And speaking of which, let us go to our book. Writing the memoir.
Oh, that's right. We've been reading a craft book, Writing the Memoir.
Yes.
If that's not a hint, I don't know what one is. Renee will finish her book. I'm talking about myself in the third person. Oh, dear Lord. I'm going to say it out here to our listeners. I have committed to finishing this dime memoir by the end of the year. If it's not finished, I'm moving on to something else. Damn it.
Yes. We'll find another craft book for something else to write after that.
Well, I have some fiction in me.
Yes.
And I'd rather write that. And I'm so sick of this book. Anyway, no. For real. 1 year, that's it. And I'm done with the draft, and it has to go submitting into the world.
So this chapter is called Finding Form.
That's a very poetry way to think.
We talked about form in fiction books as well. We talked about the structure and how basically you had your plot, which is what all the things that happened, and then the structure was the way that you told it. Like, do you start with flashbacks? Do you jump around? Apparently you can do it with memoir too. Although the most obvious thing I would think for someone writing a memoir is you write it chronologically, the way it happened.
Right. And Bickham called it structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. You know, he had his scene, things happening in chronological order, and then you would have a sequel, and in that sequel, you know, there would be maybe a flashback, but mostly it's the character musing and trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a memoir, it's taking on a different shape.
Right. In general, what do you think the difference between a memoir, shape of memoir, versus the shape of fiction?
Oh, man. I don't know. I mean, I think there's so many shapes. That's asking about, like, the shape of the universe.
Because I was thinking about the Bickham book and how many tricks he does to make the shape of a story. Like, the whole idea that everything's supposed to get worse and worse and worse until the very end when it gets better. Or every scene has a goal, a scene goal, and usually it ends in a failure in some way, shape, or form. When you're writing fiction, you control all these things. You can make things go worse and worse and worse until the very end. But in memoir, you don't have that luxury. Like, life happens the way life happens. And fiction, we get to do all these tricks so it feels like life, but it really isn't. Because we're using plot to bring the story about. We're adding characters to bring the story about. But in memoir, you have to use different structures because you can't just change the ending or change big parts of it to suit a plot.
It's all about the drama. Right. It's what makes it entertaining. Mm-hmm. And you have to be careful because you can't lie in a memoir to make something more entertaining. Whereas in a novel, that's all you're doing.
Right. Or even the set of chronology. Like in fiction, you can make sure all things happen within a short period of time. But in memoir, you might have some event that happens. And then 2 years later, the culmination of that event through something else. And a whole bunch of stuff happens in the middle. If you wrote it chronologically, it wouldn't work. You have to figure out some way to make it feel like a narrative, even though one's life doesn't happen like a narrative.
Right. So I guess the similarity is that you are taking things from your life and you are removing things or altering things in order to make a dramatic effect, to make it entertaining to the reader, just like you would do in fiction. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of fictional elements. There's a lot of flashbacking. There's a lot of stuff like that that you'll see in a memoir. But a memoir, I think, in terms of how the story is told, it has both more freedom and less freedom, which is why I think it has a lot of weird forms that you don't see in fiction as much.
Right. I took these examples she gave as kind of ways that people manage to make it feel more like a narrative or feel more like fiction while still being truthful and not changing things.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like they're playing, depending on the way they're doing it, it's not just to make it feel like fiction. I think they have a different thing going on. More, in fact, to try to capture how weird memory works.
Okay.
You know, they're trying to simulate how odd it is, or not. I don't know how to describe that. I feel like memoir tries to do that. It tries to capture something going on with a person writing it in terms of either, like, whatever they're most fascinated about. Like, is it how memory is working? Is it how trauma manifests itself? You know, is it how memories change? I think a lot of memoirists latch onto something like that, and that kind of guides the form. Whereas in fiction, it's usually the story that guides the form.
I see.
Or I'm wrong. I don't know.
Anyway, in this chapter, she goes over several different memoirs and talks about what sort of form they used and gives examples of how it worked. And we can talk about these, but also maybe talk about why. She didn't go as deeply into why the author may have chose that form. And just from perspective of you writing a memoir or me writing fiction, why we think they might have used those techniques.
Well, real quick, first, she says in the chapter, this kind of helps lay out what she's talking about in this chapter in terms of form and why she's talking about it. She says, the form, parentheses, of memoir must actively enhance the subject matter, subtly reveal layers of meaning, and complement the shape of the story with its own pleasing structure. So essentially, if you're a memoirist and you're writing, you're going to choose a form based on those criteria. And then she has the examples, as Kim mentioned.
So she starts off with some writers, memoirists, who wrote actually a series of essays. for their memoir. And each of the essays could stand on their own, but they could be linked up together. And together they formed a much bigger point. One of them, Remembering the Bone House by Nancy Mayers, as the fragmented form of essays, each concentrating on a house or houses important to my growth as a woman. So each essay is focused on one of the houses, maybe things that happened in it, things that changed for her, all these elements. And then together, you just see one house after another house to make the whole story fit.
Right.
And one advantage of doing this is when parts of your life overlap, obviously, probably she wasn't living in these houses at the same time, but when you're writing a memoir, you might find that there are a bunch of elements that fit together, but there are other things happening at the same time. Sometimes you have a story, or sometimes you're writing a memoir, and maybe you're talking about grief or loss of something, but there are good things happening, too, during that time, and you want to tell that part of the story, too, but it wouldn't make sense to tell it chronologically because it'd be kind of jarring. So this kind of grouping of things into sub-stories and then linking them all together allows you to pull the details together that fit for that part of the story.
Right. I think it also matters on why you're telling the story. So she does emphasize in here again, theme. That is like the driving force of the memoirs. You have to have a theme. And even all of these structures, they each revolve around some kind of theme. They're just doing it differently.
Okay.
In the essay form, I would believe, I mean, I guess authors are doing different things, but if a memoirist or an author who wants to write memoir and do it in essay form is doing it for a reason, and it's usually to include more commentary. It gives you more freedom, in a sense, because in an essay, you can bring in facts from the outside world. You're not just limited to things that happen in front of you. You can make commentary on things. You can maybe even bring your present self in more instead of just talking about a past event. You could revolve around one event. You could look at one thing that happened to you and then just kind of turn it over and over and over again into different topics,
mm-hmm.
right? All revolving around the same theme. There was one I was looking up just now. I have it at home. I'm hoping I remember. I haven't read it in a long time, but it's called The Telling by Zoe Zolbrod. It's sort of about a childhood sexual abuse. So it's about that one thing, but it's an essay form. And then there's one called The Ribcage. I forget who it's by, but it's a series of essays about being queer. That person has something to say about that experience, and they want to focus a lot on that opinion of it and the things that surround it and points they want to make more than just dramatizing
the events of their life being queer.
Right.
Okay.
I think. I could be wrong, but that's where I would go.
Yeah, I could see if I had a memoir that was a series of essays, I could approach it more intellectually than I would one that was just a straight narrative. So the, another one, they talk about jumping around through time. Often in a memoir, the what happens is stated very clearly at the beginning. So there's no surprise, but you read the memoir to find out why that happened, the events that led up to it, the way it made the author feel. And so there's a lot of time jumping in memoir.
Yeah.
Not just flashbacks.
Right. In fact, you'll find a lot of like dot, dot, dot. You'll find these little asterisks or just, you know, some spaces. Don't even read the book. You just skim through and you just look at the shape of things. You'll find a lot of memoirs will have like big gaps. There would be like 4 paragraphs, 5 paragraphs, gap. 4 or 5 paragraphs, gap. 2 paragraphs, gap. So they're leaping.
Mm-hmm.
From point to point. And yeah, they do jump around a lot. Like The Glass Castle. Everyone's read that one, so everyone knows what I'm talking about here. That one starts at the end in the prologue, but then it does go in order.
Right.
It goes from her being a child all the way up.
Right.
So there's not a lot of time jumping.
But there is an aspect, because we get introduced to her as an adult at the beginning, that she examines those events as a child, but also through her mind as an adult.
Yeah, that's another issue with memoir, and I'm still kind of grappling mm-hmm. a bit with it. The person telling the story is 2 people.
Yeah.
3 people. There's the person you are now, there's the person you were then, and then there's the author.
The person writing right now.
3 people, or you could say 2 people, I guess. When do you switch back and forth? And some authors do and some authors don't. Like if you read that other famous one everyone's read, Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes, he sticks to the kid's voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sticks through it, and as he ages, his voice changes.
I think the exercise we're going to do at the end will give us a chance to practice that a bit.
Cool.
So, yeah, jumping through time. I liked the Vivian Gornick example, fierce attachments, where part of it is to hold present tense with her and her mother walking and talking, and part of it is written in past tense with things that happen in the past, and the interspersed. So you can tell immediately when you get a hold of the tense where you are in the book, time-wise.
I was reading a piece in an online magazine, I think it's called just Memoir Magazine. It was toggling between writing about an event that happened when he was a kid, and it would be like two paragraphs, and then it would jump, and it would be in the future as him as a teacher, writing about a student.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would jump back to himself as a kid. The teacher was not present in the past. He didn't bring in that voice.
Okay.
And then he would go back as his teacher self. And he wasn't bringing the pieces together in the sense so obviously. You had to keep reading it to kind of see how they were like forming together.
I think we give memoirs a certain amount of freedom to do that because it's like, you know, when you have someone that's telling you a story, you let them tell the story the way they want to tell it.
Yeah.
Because it's their story.
Yeah. Oh, she does mention Lucy Greeley's Autobiography of a Face.
Uh-huh. You read that one?
I have read that one. I read that one in grad school. It is really good. It is really disturbing. Lucy Greeley. Whew, that book. Man.
What is it about?
So from my memory of reading it, it was about this woman who, when she was born, she had a lot of messed up stuff on her face, and she had to go through a ton of surgeries throughout her life. It wasn't just cosmetic, like it was painful, and there was all sorts of stuff going on with it, and like, you know, they had to reconstruct parts of her face and parts of her nose. And so growing up, I think she had like 20 surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And of course her face is disfigured and disturbing looking, you know, and that's gonna affect how you go through life. In the end, she ended up getting hooked on heroin, partly because of all the drugs she was on, the medications and opioids she was probably taking for the pain. And so then she just switched over to heroin. She talks about that too. She goes, of course, unfortunately, she did die, obviously, after she wrote the book. Yeah, it's pretty disturbing. It's pretty disturbing, but it's written like the voice is so snarky. What I love about her is there's like no pity there.
Mm-hmm.
She refuses to accept any of that crap. It's so tragic to lose such a writer, but she was so good at what she did. She just made you feel like you had problems, not her. It was really good. Anyway, so Barrington brings her up. She says there's 12 pieces with titles like Petting Zoo, Truth and Beauty, many of which stand alone, although together they tell a whole story.
And then the final one I was going to do was she has an example of Gretchen Ehrlich's A Match to the Heart, subtitled One Woman's Story of Being Struck by Lightning.
I wonder what that book's about.
I wonder. And her comment is that in this book, there's both the experience of what happened to her with the lightning, but also there's a bunch of science behind it, and it's interwoven. And that is a technique where I think part of it is to expand the story a little bit, because, you know, that could probably be a very short novella, unless there are other things that are happening to you. But when your focus is being struck by lightning, it's a very immediate event with immediate results. So the book is made larger with all these elements of science. I was going to say, as a science journalist, often we'd have the science story and then we'd hunt out somebody that was affected by or some narrative to put into the piece, because that could keep your readers reading longer.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I wonder if Gretel Ehrlich is a journalist.
Maybe. Or maybe she just researched a lot about it because she was interested in it. From the science writer's perspective, sometimes they'll even be part of your life that's been affected, but you bring in your science journalism and you include a whole bunch of science and a whole bunch of information.
Kind of like Jack Krakauer. Have you heard of him? He wrote that one about that kid who went to Alaska and died into the wild.
Okay.
And he wrote Missoula about a bunch of rapes on campus. Anyway, so what he does is it's not just about the subject. He actually writes in the first person about him doing the research and also his experiences trying to get interviews and sometimes not being able to get them, which makes that person look bad.
So what this means is that when you're writing a memoir, you have a lot of different ways to tell the story. That kind of moves into the next thing with, like, how do you pick the shape of your story? How do you figure out what your memoir shape should be? Because it's very obvious, like, oh, I'm going to do a series of essays on these topics. We're looking at some very masterful memoirs where they knew exactly what these kind of techniques. But like for just someone who's writing their own memoir, how easy is it to find the form that your memoir takes, Renee?
Oh, well, I guess I can only speak for myself. But unfortunately, it's been quite a ride. It's changed quite a lot, and I've been working on it for like 5 years or something.
Judith Barrington brings up her own experience when she was writing her memoir, Life Saving, and she said that, you know, she had a hard time. It was a series of events after her parents had died in this horrific accident. She wanted to bring the grief of that in, but it wasn't quite holding together. And then she had this idea for a chapter of a class she took as a kid on life saving, and she wrote it out. But rather than just put it at the beginning of the book and then continue, she kind of broke it up. And each chapter got a bit of this other chapter interspersed. What she said was, as I cut the life-saving section into short pieces of a few sentences each and placed them between stories, I was astonished to find that several of them related directly to the stories that followed or preceded them. My book had found its form, at least for the time being, but as often is the case, my satisfaction was premature. So she used that format to write the book and to keep it together and to give it form. And then in the end, she discovered that each of those chapters addressed those ideas. So she took out the life-saving chapter in the end, or she included it in the very end of her book.
Yeah, but it helped her get there.
Uh-huh.
Helped her figure out what the shape would be. What she's saying here is you're not going to know what your form is. Some people do, but some people don't. And she says, sometimes clues about form emerge as your material begins to take shape. The words may start to fall into a pattern or follow a rhythm. And then she says, which is not heartening, she says, relying on blind faith that sooner or later it will appear. And that is not fun.
A lot of bumping around in the dark.
Yeah. And so if you're writing a memoir, here's some advice I thought was helpful. She says some memoirs have begun as letters to the author's children, as extended journals, collections of photographs, or as poems. And then she said that her book started as, quote, Poetry and Prejudice, a 17-page memoir as a narrative poem, one which grew longer and longer but never satisfied my need to speculate about the events it describes. So then it became a memoir.
Right. Your memoir started as some poetry too, didn't it?
It did. It was a memoir in verse. It started out very experimental. I could read a bit if you want, but I don't have to. But a lot of it's been not trashed, but pretty trashed. Like a lot of it I just don't use. I've got hundreds upon hundreds of pages that I just am not using. Well, part of it is me trying to figure out how to write memoir because it's a whole new genre. And I did put all my eggs in the poetry basket many, many, many years just focused on poetry. And then I switched my genre.
One thing you could take from this chapter is that form can have both an effect on the final product, but also on getting you to write the actual book in the first place. There are ideas and forms that will help you just get the words out and get the stories out. And then there's another stage where you look at what you have and you craft it into a memoir. And that might involve cutting things out or rearranging stuff or moving stuff around. That's kind of the stage where you're at because you've got the whole story.
Yeah. The evolution of my book was first it was a memoir in verse and I wrote a lot of it. And it was very snarky. It was prose poetry, a lot of leaps, a lot of bounds. And then I got some feedback on it, paid a professional to give me some feedback. And with their guidance, I ended up writing more of a straight up chapter. And they said, hey, I know you like this other stuff, but what you just write is really good. And I was like, damn it. Okay, so then I realized, no, I have to maybe change my idea. So I started writing more like chapters. Then the subject matter started bogging me down because I was taking on too big of a scope. Now, there are a lot of coming-of-age memoirs. It's not like my scope of timeline was even that bad. Like, it was a long period, but a lot of people write from when they're a kid all the way through up growing up. It's a coming-of-age memoir. It took me a long time to realize I have too much going on in my childhood, and I either need to focus on maybe a few of those things or not cover such a large timeline. So I started thinking of ways to maybe cut around that. You know, I started thinking, well, can I experiment a little bit? And, you know, do I use photographs? Maybe I tried using like a photo album and I thought, okay, that's getting a little cliche. I realized that wasn't going to work very quickly. Then I started trying to like focus each chapter on a different relative. I'm like, okay, maybe each chapter is just a different person.
Can they be essays then? Like each one could sort of stand by its own, but it all would fill together to give a portrait of Renee.
Yeah, and it wouldn't not so much be an essay. It would still be more like telling a story about this person, but that story would be a stand-in for who this person was and my relationship to them and how I became who I was. And then they would all add up into the end. And that might actually take shape someday, maybe. But then I abandoned that because I decided to cut all of those characters out. Now, keep in mind, dear listener, this has been going on for like 5 years, okay? So I've been changing my mind. So now the focus even changed, and now it is no longer a coming-of-age memoir so much. It's about my mother's death because my mom died about year three or four into writing this book, and a lot of the material I already wrote is not going to work anymore, and I decided this is the book I want to write to make the statements I want to make. And so now, hopefully, final shape, it focuses on my mom dying, that present self of the person in the book, dealing with my mother's death in the sense that I'm watching her die in the hospital. So a lot of the scenes take place in a hospital. And then based on our conversations or based on things that happen in the hospital, they kind of take me back. And then I think of things in the past as me and my mother grapple in a relationship, trying to figure things out before she's gone. So now it's no longer just a coming of age book. It is a mother-daughter relationship memoir, which there's a whole genre of those.
Absolutely. You know, I think the other thing this teaches us is that when you've got a form that seems to be working for your memoir, you should write as much as you can, as fast as you can, and get it down, because if you put it aside and come back to it, you may have discovered a different form that you like better, and then you're back to the drawing board again.
Yeah, I mean, for me, part of it for me, not everybody. I am hard on myself and I read my old stuff and I kept looking at it going, this is not up to par. I could just tell. Maybe it was. Maybe it was good enough to get published. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll use all that old stuff later. But right now, looking at it for the story I wanted to tell, I was like, I don't have the skill yet and I have to keep at it. And now I feel like I have a good foothold and I feel a lot more confident.
I think that also you've changed the person. That's another element when you're writing a memoir, is you yourself are changing as you go along. For fiction, my character stops at this point. I can do all these other things in my life. Now maybe I'll percolate back into the story if I put it aside and start writing again, but the person you were before your mother died and you had those experiences with her in the hospital is different than the person you are now. Like, some people write multiple memoirs, but some people, like, I have one memoir I really want to write. I want to write about the self, and the self is changing. So I think, honestly, it's less you improving as a writer and maybe you improving as a human. No.
It might be. No, dude, it changes you. I would agree. I am a different person. I will say one of the craziest things that happens when you write a memoir is that it opens up things you didn't expect. And they warn you about this. And I thought, no, I have written and talked shit about my family for years and written about it and gotten published in poems about it. There's nothing new to uncover. And that is not true. And through the act of writing, I have discovered things.
The problem with talking about memoir is that everyone has stories to tell about themselves. It's very easy to get off topic or off track. But in the end, for this chapter on form, what would you say as someone writing a memoir, reading a craft book about how to write memoir, what did you get out of it?
This book?
This chapter.
You know, I knew a lot of this stuff already. I think the most useful stuff out of this chapter was a few bits of advice. She said, a memoir is not an autobiography, but rather a selected aspect of a life. How you select that aspect is crucial to the success of your piece. So form and structure really does matter. It's going to inform the whole topic,
Right. And when you're trying to take the narrative of your life and turn it into a memoir, there are various ways you can do that. And one of the critical ways is this whole idea of structure. What I got was actually what you were talking about, which is how much memoir is about theme and idea, and how you're not just telling an exciting story, but you're speaking to a theme. And in order to balance those two, both the excitement of the story and the theme, you can use various structural techniques like this to get at it.
Yeah. One activity, not in this book, at least I don't think it is, and I haven't even seen this in a craft book, but it's one I came up with for myself. Huh? So if maybe you don't want to use this, it's fine. But here is Renee's activity for figuring out your theme, dear listener. So one of the books that Barrington brought up, which Kim was talking about, was Gretel Ehrlich's A Match to the Heart. So you think, okay, it's about this woman getting struck by lightning. This is the title, but there's a subtitle. And go online, just look at memoirs on Amazon, and look and see how many have subtitles, a second title, a lot of them. You know what they're doing? They're telling you the theme. And what I try to do, or at least what I did, and what I think is very helpful, is to try to subtitle your book before it's even done. And that will tell you the theme. For example, A Match to the Heart. Okay, that's nice. But then she subtitles it, One Woman's Story of Being Struck by Lightning. There you go. That's the topic. That's the theme. Right? My memoir doesn't have a subtitle yet. But if I had one,
yeah,
it might be One Woman's Journey Through, or I'm actually not sure. It would have something to do with a woman and her mother trying to come to terms in repairing a relationship that was kind of doomed from the start. It would be kind of like that.
The last ditch effort to repair my relationship with my mother as we sat in the hospice.
Pretty much. Pretty much, yes. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kim. So there you go. And so then you'll read that, and some people will go, nah, not my jam.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And some people will be like, oh, yeah, I need to read that mother-daughter thing because I have a fucked up mom too. No, I don't. Well, another famous example is, oh, what was the one about the woman who hiked the Pacific Crest Trail?
Wild.
Wild. It's called Wild. That title doesn't go anywhere, right? But then there is a subtitle, and it's something like One Woman's Journey Hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, or One Woman's Healing
Hiking the Pacific Crest Trail,
or something like that, right? Like, even that famous, famous book, written very well, by the way, has a fucking subtitle. So I would encourage you, if you are writing a memoir, play around with some subtitles for your book. You don't have to use any of them, but if you're in that stage where you're not even sure what the theme is and you have all this writing done, try writing a bunch of subtitles. That might help you.
Yeah.
If I wrote a craft book, that would be an activity in my craft book.
There you go.
But before we continue, I just want to say, Kim, I'm talking about my book. What about you? You have to write memoir stuff. Even though you're not much of a memoirist, you said, you're going to have to write some from activities in this book.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have an idea of a subtitle for your book, if you wrote one?
No, because I don't actually have an idea what the book would be. You know, if we had the idea that we had from last podcast, which is my book would be One Family's Journey, or One Woman's Journey Across the Country from the Midwest to California.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I would revise that subtitle because I think there's way more in it, but it's not One Woman's Journey.
Right.
From Midwestern to... To
from Midwest to West Coast Elite. No,
pretty much. Why not?
Why not? Anyway, it would have journey in it. It would have where I started, where I stopped. I think that would be an element. Besides writing the subtitle of one's book, then there's also writing the end of one's book. This is something that you haven't gotten to for your memoir yet. And she has a little bit of advice at the end of this chapter about ending your book. As a crafter of words, she says, you will want your story to have some sense of resolution, as will your reader. I mean, that's going to be hard because you don't just want to have, and I won at the end. Everything was great. Everything was fantastic.
Right. She says your task is to provide a literary closure, some sense of resolution. But you don't want that, like, moral bow at the end.
Yeah. Honestly, this is something I wouldn't worry about too much because if you manage to get to the point where you've written your memoir and you've found some structure and it's all carrying in and it looks really good, your editor is going to help you figure out the ending.
I think that's a cop out, saying, oh, well, your editor will help you finish it. I wouldn't say that.
I would think this is the hardest part of writing a memoir, because your life doesn't end at a point. Like, there's right. more life that happens. And even if you're successful at something, you, the writer right now, know maybe it wasn't as successful. Like, it's, you can't just end it on, you know, and then I made the decision to do this thing and my life went on, because it's messy.
Mm-hmm. She even says that. She says, the problem is that life is not usually tidy or shapely. If you were writing fiction, you would have the option to using the plot to provide resolution. But memoir doesn't allow you to manipulate events or characters into a satisfying closure.
So what does that mean for your ending?
Like you were saying, it's messy.
Right. My advice here is that if you've got to the point where you've written a memoir and it's really good and the ending that is kind of messy and you don't know where to go with it, that's fine, because somebody will help you figure out how to write that ending so it fits right.
I guess.
I think that there are certain things that when you're writing, you can't have it be perfect all the way. And I think the ending might be something that really does catch you up. Because maybe. There's not an obvious ending, or you're not sure exactly where the book has to end.
I do remember in a previous draft I had written, and it maybe it'll be a different memoir that I write, but I actually had the ending in mind already. And it was not a triumphant, you know, I overcame all this crap in my life. It was actually I overcame a lot of the crap. And in the end, I found myself still trapped. It wasn't a happy ending.
No, doesn't sound happy at all.
And I think maybe a lot of memoirs end up that way, but I think they're changing now, because I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that, you know, Frank McCourt getting on the boat to America, yeah, one could argue that that's a great happy ending, right? Oh, he made it, as if America's like perfect or something, and he's finally made it here. But it's not. You know, if I were giving anyone any advice, which I probably shouldn't because I haven't even finished my own book, but my advice would be just go to the bookstore or go to the library, open up the last chapter of like five very radically different memoirs, and read the last chapter. How do they end it? Is it happy? Is it sad? How are they taking a life and wrapping it all up together? And maybe do what they did.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I have this idea for an exercise. Yeah, rather. Thankfully, we're not having to worry about writing the end of memoirs for an exercise. That would be a bit too overwhelming, since I haven't actually written a memoir. But at the end of the chapter, there are suggestions for writing, and many of them involve bigger things. So I like the first suggestion, which is write a very short, not more than 2 pages, memoir about someone outside your family from your childhood. Include your perspective both as a child and as who you are now. And I like this too, because it gives us a chance to try that technique you were talking about, where as a memoirist, you're not just writing who you were back then, but you're writing who you are now.
Let's do that.
Okay, back in a moment.
And we're back.
Before we start, why do you think she wanted us to do this exercise?
I think she wanted us to do this because memoir includes like 3 different people. It includes the author, it includes the person you were then and the person you are now.
How's the author versus the person you are now different?
Okay, maybe it includes 2 people.
This actually seems focused on another person completely. So we'll do yours for the main podcast and mine for the bonus podcast. How did you pick this person?
You know, it was kind of hard because we didn't know a lot of people.
That weren't family.
Yeah. I don't know. Mom didn't make a lot of friends, and grandma didn't let anyone come over. And, you know, we just didn't know a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually kind of hard. I was like actually thinking last night, I was like, what do I do?
And going off of that criteria, that it be a person that's not a family member that you knew as a child and possibly still know now, I'm wondering if part of the exercise also is just to force us to think about people outside our immediate family. For writing memoirs, because it's really easy just to write about your family members again and again and again. I suppose the other thing too is that when you write about family members, there's so much to them. So in a way, picking somebody that you interacted with a little bit here and a little bit there makes the exercise easier.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I think an exercise like this might be really useful if you have so much to write about your mother or your brother or grandmother or whatever, that this is kind of a more controlled set of writing to do.
Right. Well, at least for me, there was only so many memories of this person. So,
okay. Yeah.
Do you want to start by reading yours?
Sure. So again, as I wrote this and I read it and then I read yours, I was like, oh, did I do this right? I always think that. So maybe I did, maybe I didn't. We're gonna find out, dear listener. There's no title to this. We parked in front of a gate dripping in purple wisteria. I got out of the car and walked toward the purple, puffy flowers dangling down the garden gate. I noticed the sound of trickling water before I saw the pond just beyond the front porch of the cottage. Large iridescent orange and black koi circled under lily pads of algae, surrounded by stone slate. The front yard had been artfully landscaped in green vines, Japanese maples, rushes with long fern-like leaves jutting from all sides. Cobblestone pathways led to a wooden cottage and wound around 100 feet to the back of the yard, where water dripped from another fountain into yet another koi pond. I was standing in a landscaping magazine, a tea garden, an expensive nursery that exists only in quaint downtowns and elaborate cafes. This was my front yard, I thought. A tall, lanky man in his 70s with deep-set eyes approached, who I later learned was the owner and builder of this place. His name was Owen, and he was the father of one of my mom's co-workers at the psych facility at Chomp, which is how we learned the place was for rent. I later learned Owen had recently lost his wife and didn't want to live in the house anymore, so bought a fancy RV, built a deck with a hot tub sunk into it, and lived in the backyard. He gave me a tour while Mom and John pulled our items from the car. Inside the cottage, a wood-burning stove with a tall chimney flue rose through the ceiling. Benches lined the walls. Owen lifted the seat of one of them, joined by a hinge, and pointed out various boarded-up holes in the side of the walls. These were for the otters, he said. Otters? You owned otters? I asked, my mind full of otters with long whiskers and black eyes slipping through the hidden compartments in the walls. Yes, long ago. They were great fun. He took me through the back door in the kitchen and showed me a large backyard, the end of which sat his gigantic, expensive-looking mobile home and hot tub surrounded by a deck. He told me he himself lived in the mobile home, a permanent fixture in the backyard, and I immediately loved this man with his 40-year-old fish and stories about house otters who built a sanctuary in the middle of nowhere. Oh, and the house, it all felt like a fairy tale, complete with the dead wife, the grieving old husband, the magical cottage in the woods. I felt an overwhelming sense of comfort then, especially after the weeks followed and I learned just how both quiet and loud and dark the woods can get. I was not used to the quiet and was afraid to stare too deeply through my window at night for fear something, a serial killer, monster, anything wanting to torture me before it killed me, rushed toward the glass. Perhaps it's because living most of my life within the thin walls of apartments, the sounds of other families drifting through the breadboard, that I find the sounds of voices and movement comforting. I work best at the kitchen table while I can hear my husband play his video games in the adjacent room. A latchkey kid since 6 years old, I suspect the auditory din of life gave the illusion I was being watched, but in a good way, cared for. I spent my childhood falling asleep to sirens evaporating into the darkness, voices approaching and departing, the silence cracking from backfiring cars or something else. It became a familiar lullaby. It's why I fell asleep each night to the Lord of the Rings extended edition on my laptop for the 8 months I lived alone in an apartment for the first time when I was in my 30s. But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. In Carmel Valley, there were no such sounds. At night in our backyard, the lights from Owen's trailer reflected off the crickets and moths hidden in the yard at night. In Carmel Valley, Owen became my guard against the dark. Owen keeping watch. Owen was listening. I could sleep now.
Beautiful descriptions. Have you included any of this in your actual memoir?
Some of it, yeah. Actually, now that I've written this, it's probably I'm just going to take the whole thing wholesale after some editing and throw it right in. So I
Yeah.
extended something I'd already written, but it sounds way better now.
Was this the same house that you had the encounter with the dogs at?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It started out really good. You'll have to go to some previous episodes to get what happened to those dogs, dear listener.
Yes. So, what you said, you did have a lot of adults that weren't family members growing up that you had consistent contact with. So here, what you were doing is you had Owen and his house, and then in a way, since you had to have the adult you kind of just reflected back and looked at your current lifestyle as comparison, right?
Yeah. There wasn't actually much. The me now, I threw in things only I could know now, like figuring out why he was a comforting person.
Yeah, I think that was part of the exercise. The mention she has in the book says that she talked about a person that was describing the person that he knew as a child and then who he knew as an adult. So I think that you have to bring in the you are now. And the way I first envisioned this was, well, okay, you write about the person when you knew them when you're young, and now you'd write about them when you knew them when they're old. But that's not always an easy thing to do, especially to separate that. It tends to overlap, I found in the writing.
Yeah. And you got to be careful, like in paragraphs. At least I think about like when I switch over to something I know now that I didn't know then, I try to just make it a new paragraph.
Was there any difficulties you had when you were writing this?
I was keenly aware of when I was switching into what I know now, because a lot of it is what I know now. A lot of it is I have to figure out what I knew then and what I knew now. I think I remember he actually did say, tell me about the otters on the first time I looked at the house. But I would argue that I don't know if I even knew there was a second koi pond until the next day. Like it was like, holy crap, there's another koi pond in the back. I may have seen it, I don't know, but I felt like, for brevity's sake, it's easier to just put that whole description all at once.
That's completely allowed in memoir. I mean, you're going to compact things together.
And also, I was aware there wasn't much of a plot. This is more like the beginning of a chapter. Is it a story? Well, there's no conflict. There's not much of a conflict anyway. I don't really get one, besides maybe talking about living in apartments and they're not all great.
2 pages of memoir, you're not going to get much, especially for an exercise. Maybe if it's something you work on for a really long time, there'll be more to it, but this is an exercise. This is meant to capture a memory that you had as a child and kind of examine it also as an adult.
Whenever we do these activities, I always think back to Gardner. We hated on him a lot, but one thing he mentioned was that, nothing is wasted. Whenever you do a writing activity, try to do it in the spirit of a larger piece that you're working on. I try to do that. And so that's what I did here.
So that's another reason to have this exercise in this book, because it's forcing us to pick some person that's outside the standard set of people we think of for a memoir. And maybe that will bring in some other elements. Like here, obviously, it was bringing how safe you felt with Owen in the yard versus other times of your life, which fits with your memoir.
And I would say, like, my early attempts at writing the memoir, I focused a lot on what I knew now and writing about, like, from my perspective now to then, but not really getting into myself as a character back then. I had a really hard time figuring out how to do that. And I just thought, oh, I'll just skip that part. And then as it grew and it got longer and I started getting more workshops, I realized, oh, wait. The scenes need to be in there. And when they mean scene, they mean from back then, as what you're going through. So I had to learn how to do that. And then when I switched it over to me now, with my mom, I'm constantly switching between scenes going on while mom was dying and then switching within those chapters all the way to a scene that happened in the past. And I've been doing this for a while now. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm doing pretty good now. I can kind of tell the difference when I'm like, switching from a scene that was just a couple of years ago to a scene that was like 30 years ago.
I really got the feel of a young Renee coming to this house and seeing it, the things that you focused on, like, the otters and the koi ponds and just those elements that are very detailed to a kid as opposed to who you are now.
I have those thoughts now. Like, I'm the first one that wants to go to the petting zoo. I'm kind of a kid. So honestly, I'm as excited about the otters now as I probably was then.
The words petting zoo in my head are forever linked to Gravity Falls. I'm going to pet you, and I'm going to pet you, and oh boy, am I going to pet you.
I am so grateful you made me watch that show. In
It's
fact, I think I've got to re-binge it because it was that good.
that good.
It's that good, man.
I think you did a great job on this exercise. Do you think you did
Thank
well?
you. If I turn this into Barrington, do you think she'd give me an A?
Yeah, I think it's really wonderfully described. I think you really touched upon somebody that you knew back then, and you got to what your feelings about them then were. And while you didn't have the convenience of like knowing them as an adult, so you didn't have that option, You did a really good job of using his house to represent who he was, and then to contrast kind of your memories of that house now versus places that you live now. It can be a tricky exercise for somebody that moves around and doesn't have some identifiable adults that have been with them through their life, and you came up with a really good solution.
What? Oh, hey, I follow the prompts.
There you
What?
go.
I
And
did not
it's on our
know
regular
this.
episodes so our audience can listen to it.
Yay! Proof I did it
We'll do my answer in the bonus podcast. But before that, we've got something new that we are doing on our meetup channel. Usually, once a week, we do a process group, which has been working really well. And since we do it every other week, that means we have a Wednesday evening where we're don't have anything scheduled. And so we're going to do a writing spree where people can log in to the meeting and we will write for basically 2 hours. But because we love to educate, we're going to include a short little craft lecture that Renee's got several ideas for, like about 10 minutes of that. If you want to listen to it, you certainly can. If you don't, you just want to write, you can write. But we welcome you to check it out.
Cool.
Our meetup group is called Words to Write By Podcast, or you can go to our website, wordstowritebypodcast.com, and find a link there.
Yep, and it'll take you right to the meetup page, and they'll be both on the same page. So you can do the process group, you can sign up for the process group and the writing spree.
Yes. Thank you guys all for listening. If you've been enjoying this podcast, could you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to, or a rating? We want to get more people listening to this. The more people that we get writing reviews and rating, the more visibility we'll get and the more listeners we'll get.
And please share it with a friend you think that could use it.
Excellent. You guys take care.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Kim's looking at me. She's smiling. She's like, I'm cutting so much of this story out. Oh my God, if she will just stop talking.